Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. I'm Charlotte Metcalf, and today I'm delighted to be talking to Emma, the Duchess of Rutland, who spared time to talk to me as she makes the final preparations for the marriage of her oldest daughter, Violet Manners, to Viscount Greenock. For those who don't know the Duchess's story, she grew up on a Welsh farm and trained initially as a singer before marrying David Manners, the Marquess of Granby, in the 80s. When David's father died, David inherited both the title and Beaver Castle, the upkeep of which Emma has made her life's work. Her autobiography, The Accidental Duchess, published in 2022, is a gloriously open and honest account of her life. And with her books, television programmes and podcast, she's really lifted the lid on the realities of taking on and running one of Britain's most significant historic houses. Emma, a very, very warm welcome to Radio Oldie.
Oh, thank you. I love the name Radio Oldie, Charlotte. Nice to see you again.
Well, very nice to see you. And it's an absolute delight to have you on. We've got a lot to talk about, but let's go back to the beginning, as there's that wonderful story around how you came to be at Beaver, about you making the mistake of thinking your husband was a publican. Just tell us about meeting David.
I know. Oh, goodness. So I met David at a dinner party in London, hosted by someone called Christopher Cole. Now, Christopher Cole owned that wonderful wallpaper business called Cole's. We'd happened to bump into him, my partner, who was my business partner in my interior decorating business that I'd set up, at Decorex. And anyway, he randomly said to Janet Baker and myself, "Oh, why don't you come for dinner tonight? I'm hosting a dinner party." We were staying at the Farmers Club and in London, and my business partner was busy, was seeing a friend. And so I said, "Yes, that'd be lovely." So I met David at this dinner. And at the end of the evening, he was sort of lurking around rather and wouldn't leave. And I was most probably feeling a bit nervous and wondering when to leave. He said, "Oh, I really enjoyed meeting you. Can I give you my business card?" And he gave me his business card, and then off we went our separate directions. And I showed it to my brother back on the farm in Wales the next day, and I read it out. I can still remember now saying, "I met this charming guy, Will, last night at a dinner in London." And this, who said, "Who is he?" And I said, "Oh, well, this is who he is." And I read the name. The card said, "The Marquess of Granby, David Manners, registered firearms dealer." And William said, without a breath of hesitation, "I think you need to stay well away from him. He's either a gun runner or he owns a pub." And that, of course, I do now know, Charlotte, thank goodness. It took me years to really realise why. But because there are 1,200 pubs in the UK called the Marquess of Granby.
1,200, that bit I didn't know. Gosh.
Yes, and the reason for that, which I find even more interesting, is because the first Marquess of Granby, David's ancestor, in the Seven Years' War, was very gracious. He was the one that lost his wig, and from him came the expression, "going for it bald-headed." But he was very gracious to all his troops. And when they all left and returned home, he was the first ever person to give people who bought in these private armies money. And they bought a little cottage when they got home and turned many of them into pubs. So that's a really living history that's with us to this day in every Marquess of Granby pub you may ever have visited.
So what stage did you find out he was neither a gun runner nor a publican?
Oh. Well, of course, you could remember, as we are so old, and I've never really done the internet anyway and never Googled anyone. I'd never met a sir, an honourable. It just didn't come into my world. So it didn't really clock until months, and we started phoning and talking to each other on the phone every day and getting to know each other's lives. And he certainly didn't disclose who he was. I knew it was Leicestershire, and the only thing I thought and knew about Leicestershire was pork pies. And when I arrived here on the way up to a wedding, actually, in Yorkshire, he said, oh, stay for lunch. And he lived in a place called the Old Saddlery, which was below the castle in a sort of converted stable block. And we went for a walk after lunch around the grounds, around the saddlery. And I said, oh, it's amazing. Who lives there? He said, my parents. And it was then. So then.
And now it's been your home for how long?
We moved into the castle in 2021. And my father-in-law passed away in 1999. And I think, and then Hugo, our last child, was born here in 2003.
So 2001 rather than 2021. Yeah, 2001.
Yeah, 2001.
Yes, yeah, yes.
2001. 2001.
Yeah, and you've had five children.
Yes. Yeah. Four of the children were born outside the castle. We had a wonderful sort of Georgian house on the estate. And I remember thinking, you only really know when you're in the thick of a world like this that the reality is it looks far more glamorous looking in than it really is when you're within it. And I remember thinking, how am I going to get the pram up and down those spiral stairs? And there's no garden to push them out in the sunshine, you know, on a lovely hot day. So there are really practical sort of things about bringing up the children. And there wasn't really any space in the castle that we could honestly say was homely. There was no kitchen, because the kitchen was on another floor. Mm. And the only thing that mattered to me was, you know, being in the kitchen and my children around me while I made them another spag bol or whatever you were doing as a mum. So that it was the real things that really matter.
I love you saying there's no garden, because, of course, it's the most enormous garden that you once said was so huge you could only ever be a visionary. You couldn't actually get into gardening it because it was so enormous. So there is a garden, but it's how big?
Yeah, it's not the sort of back garden. What we have is I then turfed so we can see grass, because everything's very high. And so you look out on the north terrace, which is sort of tarmac and lots of cars, from my office, for example, where we are now. So I turfed the top terrace, which obviously is straight onto concrete. So that took a lot of keeping right, like a roof terrace. And that became our grass, the easy bit to sort of get out to. But of course, I do hear you. If I'm the outsider looking in, how could you ever make a comment like that, Emma? Because there are thousands of acres, but it was just how you felt at that moment.
Yes.
And I suppose everything was about getting my mind around the expanse of what one needed doing, how to be practical, and how to try and make it work. And I'm still struggling with that every day.
But you have made it work enormously. I mean, you know, you've done so much.
I know. And someone very wise, a friend from Herefordshire who had his own estate, once said to me, the best thing, I said, he said, are you excited? I said, I don't know if I'm excited. When my father-in-law died, I'm terrified. You know, we had dark suited men arriving with one after another sort of shred of doom and gloom about the tax situation and where was the money. And we had a survey doing of the condition of the castle, and it ideally needed about 10 million spending on it that moment. So of course those are all people's views. The roof is not leaking, and that's the first job for me to do, was to sort out the roof, because if the roof leaks, you're stuffed, aren't you? So the roof was my priority. And just a little story about that moment in time, because we had two people come in to give their quotes. One was a very practical sort of surveyor who'd had done Lincoln Cathedral and lots of the churches, and the other was a sort of an architect and a this and a that, and a whole team of people who came and rubbed their hands together with glee, saying dukes and duchesses and castles and thinking of lots of money. And the one quote was for about 80,000 and the other was for 7. And I remember saying to both, just explain, go through exactly. And it was very obvious, you know, the 7,000 quote was just repairing and replacing everything that was there. So these great thick Welsh slates, they just repaired them, put them back in place, and then insert. So I went for the cheaper quote, I'm afraid, because it just made sense. But along my journey, the reason for telling that story, Charlotte, is that's the way I tried to be practical about all those decisions that can be big decisions, but you can make them simple. And the, going back to the friend from Herefordshire, he said the little and less you do with these big estates, the better, because generally just make them work. Mm-hmm. And don't, you know, try and build a golf course or build a this, or don't let your ego get in the way of anything to do with heritage, because it will always beat you.
It is very, 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 very large. I mean, I do remember going round it once with your daughters, and I think they went into a room they weren't sure they'd been in before. It's magnificent and a huge legacy for you. But what else have you done? So much more than fix the roof.
Well, what have I done in my journey here? I think to begin with, it was a question of just getting my head around the castle and this part. So one of the things, not for any reason, and sometimes I misquoted it, the castle wasn't in shreds, but it just had a generation living here from wartime. And anyone who'd come out of the war and Second World War, they were sort of condensing their world and their lives.
Yes.
That's how their mentality most probably was. So what I did in this building is just virtually throw away the ropes and make sure we could live and breathe and as a family and enjoy every room. So we have done that. And let me tell you, there have been, you know, there's always something that suffers when you do that. Every dining room is now functional. I put kitchens everywhere. I've done up every room, often borrowing, begging fabric, secondhand curtains from Stapleford Park, which is a huge hotel near here. And because I was a decorator, I've got a whole linen room of bits and bobs where I can go and create, you know, curtains. I have an amazing team of curtain makers, upholsterers, restorers. But you build this on your journey. So this was the first bit. Then I realised it was about 2012 that the archivist came to see me from the archives and produced this rolled up map with an old ribbon, and untied it and said, "We found gold." I said, "Well, not quite. It doesn't look like gold to me." This is the original Capability Brown map and plan of this landscape. But of course, what we began to realise, Charlotte, is the fourth Duke died at the same time as Capability Brown, and so both were lost. So we didn't know that this was a Capability Brown landscape, but luckily I was then introduced to this sort of expert in Brown, Johnny Phibbs, and asked him to come up. We had a... we've got some government grant to help look at this landscape correctly. And we realised that Spires, Jonathan Spires, who was the surveyor for Capability Brown, he had carried on working for the family for some 15 years after Brown's death.
And you did a television programme about it with Alan Titchmarsh, didn't you?
We did. Mm. Alan was amazing. He's such a perfectionist. And he caught me out quite a few times as I removed trees, because I just thought that, said, "Why have you taken those out?" But you have to, in many of the landscapes around the castle, it had to be quite dramatic. in order to really clear the ground and then replant. And so now we've got about 150 acres of woodland garden. And what I've done is work with a great dear friend of mine called Charlie Williams from Carr Hayes Castle, who has a Berncous nurseries, which is unbelievable for magnolias, rhododendrons, azaleas, all those lovely woodland plants with the woodland garden and trees, and just clear that areas and then plant it up. We planted thousands of camellias. It's a brilliant in the spring, but we're coming up to Vi's wedding now on Saturday, and you know it's quite stressful in the summer because it gets away from you. But luckily, that's what I mean about every Duchess brings something to a place like this. Violet, the eighth Duchess, put in this amazing Harold Pito rose garden, so that's where the reception will be.
Oh, how wonderful. Oh, so anyway, in your book, The Accidental Tourist, The Accidental Duchess, you were very honest about your and very moving, actually, about your breakup with David. But you still both live in the castle and make a great go of it.
To me, I didn't marry into this world. I didn't come from huge money, and I certainly didn't want it. And so when all the lawyers start saying, oh, this, that and the other, I said, no, that's not what I want. We're actually not divorced, we're just legally separated. So I said today, just let me run it. I'm so frustrated by land agents, all land agents I've ever met. and they know because I really struggle, because a lot of land agents struggle to, you know, the problem is if you're from a farming background, you're the ultimate entrepreneur because you have to make everything work. Whereas it's very easy to sell things off and just keep selling. And say, oh, it's all doom and gloom. So I always see a way around. So I've got rid of all the CEOs and the land. Well, we've got a very good land agent now, but he sort of reports into me. And I've got an MD now because I've had these health issues recently. So I've managed to find a wonderful lady who helped me as an MD. But so I didn't want any money from the breakup. I didn't want anything. So I just said, just let me run it until such time as Charles needs to take it on. And
How old is Charles now?
Charles is 26, 27 in July. And still young and, you know, just getting going and work in London, and that's where he must be.
Yeah.
So that's the thing is, I love David as much as I ever have. We're the best of mates, and we text all the time, we talk all the time. And funny enough, just after COVID, I just felt I was kind of living a bit of a lie. So I have my room here with all my wardrobes, and I had day bed and that sort of thing. But I moved into a cottage on the edge of the estate with Phil. And that's the first time we've told anyone that. So that's fresh off the press. But that's divine, and it means I can get away. And I think it was tough for the children. They're not children anymore, are they? They're adults. And so it's sort of, yeah, it was quite hard for them because mum wasn't here anymore. But I made sure I have a bedroom for all of them. Funny enough, they've never stayed there. But I still come back and cook Sunday lunch and do stuff, and I do my work from here every day, so I haven't really left. It won't let me go, this place, because I always say I have this ghost, which is the fifth Duchess, called Elizabeth, and she was from Castle Howard, and I always, because I'm quite spiritual, I always feel that she found me to do the job here, and she just won't let me go. If I wanted to, she wouldn't let me, so...
Well, let's get on to that, because your podcast that you started in 2021, was it, with Violet?
Yes.
It was very, you started talking to lots of people running, women in charge of big estates like you. And what from listening to them, what really came out of all of them was this great sense of duty that you clearly have, and that you... were very good at identifying it in other women.
When you talk to the women, that, and particularly the generation of women that are running Heritage now,
yes, know,
which is different to, say, I think the clever thing is why aristocracy in this country survives is it's not really the women, it's the men who adjust. And they adjust for the needs and wants of the buildings at that time in history. So what fascinates me is that during the sort of 20s and 30s, when the states were really on their knees during that, you know, very difficult times with the wars, they all married, well, quite a few, certainly Glenn, American heiresses, didn't mm-hmm. they?
Yes.
And a lot of money came in. It was all very important to get someone with plenty of money. But now you can talk to one after another and after another, and they're all the same. Their sleeves are rolled up, and they're practical, and they're at the sharp end. And because of that, you go into these homes, Charlotte, and they are really homes. And yeah. It is not like, I'm sorry to say, going into something that's like Aspect, like trapped in time, which is what the National Trust has become. Mm. I remember Simon Jenkins saying to me years ago that really what we want to do is we want to bring the owners back, so sort of make them sort of museum pieces that come out every now and then. What we want is, National Trust want is what they will sadly never have, which is living, breathing fossils called dukes and duchesses and lords and ladies, actually footballs and, you know, all the things that make a home real. Mm. That's what they are. And the minute that's gone, you lose that magic, don't you? Because it's the woman.
Yeah.
Whatever size the house, I'll go around this house in a minute with one of our, well, we only have three cleaners. People are always amazed by that, but we do really only have three cleaners, and they're amazing. But I'll go around every square foot, even up into the towers where we store furniture, and know exactly where everything is and what needs doing, what needs sorting. We have a WhatsApp group chat. Yeah, and if something's out of place, because what can happen, and what happened here before we moved in, is the guides had taken over.
Oh.
And it was like going into, you know, one of the palaces in St. Petersburg, where they sort of frostily look at you in every room, tell you not to
touch,
and hardly, don't cough and hardly smile. So that's what had happened. So we had to regain it, really, and humanise it.
So when you moved in here and into Beaver with David, had his parents been living here?
Yes.
But in a tiny corner of it, sort of thing.
Yeah, so the state dining room was never used for meals. So that was never, so I put a kitchen at the back of that. The old nursery wing, which is where we created our family space, hadn't been lived in for about 25 years. So we completely redid that up. And the kitchen was in the basement. And at that time, the estate office was in the old estate office, which is at the below the castle. And that was where, but all the work happened. So I moved the estate office up to the castle. So this is my office, and I share it with my MD, and then I've got accountants here and the sales team here, and you know, everything happens from the castle. What it meant is that I could do this tea for the children, then run down and sort something out, and so you can juggle then.
Yes.
It is about juggling, it really is. You would be able, yes, to put on the tiara and then put it back in the box and go and do spag bol for the kids in the kitchen behind the private door.
No, absolutely. You have been, you were diagnosed with cancer last year, weren't you? Which you have written very openly. And
I was.
And how are you now?
Yeah, no, good. All good. I'm going for my last op, where they billed me back in July. And
you had a mastectomy, yes?
Exactly.
Yes, yeah.
Which is in itself, when I've reviewed the last 12 to 18 months, it was just as Violet got engaged. So I was just praying I'd have hair for the wedding. So I feel very blessed to have a head of hair. I luckily only had to have radiotherapy, so that was brilliant. And so I've become incredibly attached to my softy, which I wrote about in when I went on did a Panchakarma in Kerala, and I was horrified when I lost it, and it became the trauma, the new trauma of my life. You know,
you lost your softy,
isn't it? Lost my soft. But so it's funny how life is, isn't it? But it's in the end for me, it's been this amazing gift, because it's made me step a little away from the day-to-day grind of working at Beaver and find an amazing team around me to take the strain. And I've decided I'm going to have a bit of a sabbatical from mid-October to the end of the year, come back for Christmas, and I'm off to an ashram. So I'm going to go and live in an ashram in India, which would be so exciting.
How fantastic. Whereabouts? In Kerala or somewhere?
In Kerala. Yes. Yeah. And so I'm working with various people to get my trip organised and planned. But I think it's all these things, when they come to you, they're a sign that something that you're doing isn't quite right. And so getting an internal balance is so important, I think was probably, I had a mental breakdown about 8 years ago after marriage collapse. And I think I patched myself up and I talked. I do self Reiki, so I heal myself. But I think I need to go deeper. So that's what I'm off to do.
I remember in The Accidental Duchess, when you talk so incredibly openly about having that breakdown and just basically going to bed in your mother-in-law's bedroom for months and just being so miserable. But horses, riding was a great, brought you great sort of joy and took you out of yourself, didn't it? Are you still riding?
Oh, yes. I went out for a ride last night with Bi, who's going to get married, and Alice. And Violet's on a new horse called Winston, who's I bought for all the children. But they all decided they wanted to jump. Oh, Charlotte. And this horse is a hunter, not a show jumper. And so off he went, and she came off. He went into the jump and skidded right into it. And I thought, oh, Vi, please don't do this to me. 4 days, 5 days before you get married. But no, riding is so healing, because I think there are places in America where you can go and just spend time with horses, because you build back trust, and I think that's what you do with a horse. There's amazing trust that you have of each other. So yes, I still ride as much as I can.
And can we just, you mentioned America, can we talk about America for a minute?
Basically, Charlotte, I've been this year to Houston, which is fabulous. I'm Dallas next year. I've been to Palm Beach, and they're always so welcoming to me there. I spoke in the Four Arts, which is this enormous great sort of hall in the middle of Palm Beach, and I think there were 500 women. I mean, and the same again in Houston. And because I'm talking about the Accidental Duchess, I can bring some humor into it, and yes, I can make it real. So it's not as heavy. I used to do a talk about history and the castle. Of course, it's harder to bring that in because you have to be more serious. But this talk is, you can be fun. And well, Americans are amazing because there's nothing that they don't think is achievable. They have a very different approach to us Brits sometimes. You know, they just go out there and go for it. And of course, My girls are always amusing. They say, Mum, it's the only place on this planet you can really be a duchess. And I love dressing up for them and wearing lovely clothes. And I love Americans. I love Americans. And I always say at the end of my speech, and God bless America.
Do you think that you could have achieved the same results had it not been for Downton Abbey, because that just opened up a whole different level of interest?
You're right. And funny enough, we did what they call a Tisler, I think they call it that, nearly did a sort of program which was really showing how this estate runs 100 years after Downton Abbey.
Yeah.
Because Downton Abbey, in Americans' minds, is how we live our lives. Yeah. So I don't want to totally destroy their, you know, their vision and their ideas, but you have to have the glamour, you know, the butlers, the state dining room, the tiaras, the jewels. You have to. And it's this incredible backdrop for entertaining, and was built, really, Beaver was built as an entertaining castle. John Martin Robinson, who helped me with my book about Beaver, who's a great historian, he said it is the most beautiful unspoiled Regency castle that has ever been built. So in that sense, you have to make it special. So I line all the keepers up when the Americans arrive, and I line all the staff up with all their hats. And it does look very Downton Abbey. And do remember, I was a trained opera singer, so I understand that it is, I say, when the show is on and the curtains are up, the show's, you know, whatever's happening backstage does not really matter. The show must go on.
Do you still sing, Emma?
I sing in the bath. I sing in the car.
Did you used to smoke? I seem to remember you did.
I smoked annoyingly for too long and literally drank as well too much white wine. So my voice has gone down in pitch, but I can still sing.
Oh, wonderful.
And that's why I love the podcast, because I used to go to places and people would say, I know you because of the pod, because of your voice. And it's so nice, isn't it? Because it's much nicer to be known by your voice than by your way you look, because you're free then, aren't you?
Do you think it's a particularly the stuff you're talking about, the jewels and the pageantry, really, that Brits are known for? It's quite a specifically British thing, isn't it? Because, you know, or is that wrong? Do you think they'd be the same in Italy and Spain?
I think we can't, nowhere else in the world does it like us. That's what I feel. And I think if we drop what we're best at, our USP is one of them, is our heritage, our royal family, everything that is uniquely British.
Mm.
We lose the very core of what the rest of the world truly wants, you know? I mean, the Heart Tour is in... The Heart Tour that generates from this country is in Glastonbury, isn't it? And I remember walking up there years ago, and it has, was my, one of my ancestors was the one that saw the ley lines and wrote the book, The Old Straight Line. And so from the Heart Tour, Glastonbury radiates ley lines to the rest of the world. So we don't really realise how powerful we are. We may be having problems right now, but this island is incredible. It has the power to radiate around the world. We've just forgotten it a bit.
What a fantastic place to end. That's really encouraging. Well, I hope you have a fantastic wedding on Saturday.
And Charlotte, as ever, you're a delight, absolute joy to chat to. And I hope we'll see each other again very soon.
I hope so too. Thank you so much.
God bless.
You've been listening to me, Charlotte Metcalf, talking to Emma, the Duchess of Rutland. If you've enjoyed our conversation and would like to hear more like this, please go to www.theoldie.co.uk, where you'll also be able to subscribe to the magazine. My very, very warm thanks again to Emma, the Duchess of Rutland, to Bailey Gifford for sponsoring us, and to you for listening. Goodbye. You've been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1? I'm sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter OLD TRIAL as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter OLD TRIAL.